Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we continue our series in search of the greatest generation by taking a look at another of the most popular nominees for that much exalted title, the Civil War generation, the generation that saved the nation from complete dissolution. Fred Nielsen will be speaking with historian James McPherson. We will hear from Stephanie Kuntz, who takes issue with the whole idea of generational bonds as the way to define groups and periods in American history. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On November 27, 1895, Alfred Nobel, the Swedish chemist, engineer, inventor, and industrialist, drew up his will, which established the most prestigious of international awards, the Nobel Prizes. Upon his death in 1896, Nobel left the bulk of his immense fortune in a trust to establish the Nobel Prizes for Peace, Physics, Chemistry, Physiology, and Literature. That would be awarded annually to those who during the preceding year had conferred the greatest benefit on mankind. The first distribution of the prizes took place on December 10, 1901. At the time the prizes were announced, critics pointed to what appeared to be a contradiction in Nobel's promotion of the betterment of mankind, especially through his Peace Prize. He was, after all, the inventor and a manufacturer of dynamite. Defenders responded that Nobel was actually a pacifist who hoped that the destructive powers of his inventions would help bring an end to war. Turning items of historical interest in the news, five women branded as unrepentant witches and hanged on Gallows Hill during the hysteria of the 1692 Salem witch trials have been officially exonerated by the state of Massachusetts. The act, approved by the state legislature and signed by the acting governor, cleared the names of Bridget Bishop, Susanna Martin, Alice Parker, Wilmot Reed, and Margaret Scott, five of 20 men and women executed during the witchcraft hysteria. The state government tried to make amends before. In 1711, the Massachusetts government issued an apology and offered compensation to the relatives of most of the accused, but it took nearly 300 years for the final five of those executed to be included. Researchers conducting a study of American veterans who were imprisoned during both World War II and the Korean War have found that POWs are 25% more likely to die from heart disease. The study, reported in the Journal of Military Medicine, concluded that the tremendous stress of imprisonment and in many cases a poor diet contributed to the emergence of heart disease and strokes later in life. Previous studies of Vietnam veterans have found that those plagued with anxiety attacks or depression, symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, were far more prone to heart problems. According to a British study, more than one-third of World War II veterans suffer from some form of psychological trauma as a result of their combat experiences. This is Talking History. Most have described the Civil War generation, at least those in the North, as a people who fought to free the slaves and save the Union. Others have described that generation as blunderers who stumbled into a war that could have been avoided. Which is the case? That is the subject of Fred Nielsen's conversation with historian James McPherson.
My guest, James McPherson, a professor of history at Princeton University, is the preeminent historian of the American Civil War. Among his many books are The Struggle for Equality, Abraham Lincoln and the Second American Revolution, and For Cause and Comrades, Why Men Fought in the Civil War. He is perhaps best known for The Battle Cry of Freedom, which received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor McPherson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, first of all, about the American people in 1860 on the eve of the Civil War. How many were there? How were they distributed by race, section, ethnicity?
Well, the population of the United States in 1860 was just under 32 million. Of those 32 million, about 13% were slaves, 4 million slaves in the South, and another 500,000 free blacks, about equally distributed between North and South. There were about 5.5 million immigrants in the country, which was about 17% of the whole population, or 20% of the white population, so it was a period of our history when the percentage of immigrants in the American population was as high or almost as high as it has ever been.
Only about fourscore years, to use Lincoln's phrase, separated the Civil War from the American Revolution. The fathers were in some cases literally fathers or grandfathers. What did Americans of the Civil War era think of earlier generations, especially the founders?
They venerated the founding fathers, and in fact that had a lot to do with their motivation in fighting the Civil War. The tragic irony, I think, of American history is that Northerners and Southerners had a different conception of the meaning of the Revolution of 1776 that had founded the nation. Southerners looked back on that as the first war of secession, a war to achieve freedom and independence from what they regarded as a tyrannical government. And they said they were doing the same thing in 1861, that they were acting in the image of the founding fathers to form a new nation. Northerners interpreted the founding of the nation in 1776 as a great experiment in republican government, in democracy, and that if secession could break up the government, it would destroy that experiment. It would destroy the nation established by those venerated founders. And so the way in which both sides look back at the generation of 1776 as the greatest generation so far in American history helped to fuel the passions that brought on Civil War.
There's a lot of talk about greatest generations these days, of course. And yet, some historians over the years have looked back at the Civil War generation not so much as a great generation, but as a generation of blunderers. The politicians especially have been characterized by some historians as people who could have, and indeed should have, avoided such a tragic war. How much truth is there in such accusations?
That was an accusation associated mainly with a generation of historians prominent in the 1930s and 40s. Called the revisionists. And I think they were partly influenced by their pacifism, their belief that the United States had gained nothing by its participation in World War I and should avoid, that wars at all costs should be avoided. And they looked back on the generation of the 1850s and 1860s and called them a blundering generation because they did not avoid that war. But those historians also tended to have a blind spot, I think, on slavery and race. Any compromise that would have prevented war in 1861 would, of course, strengthen slavery because it was the South's fear that the growing northern majority, which had elected Lincoln president in 1860, would threaten the future survival of slavery that prompted them to go out. So the only way they could have been brought back in, or the only way that secession could have been avoided, would be further concessions to slavery that would increase its power in the national government, would perpetuate its existence. And so looking back today on that generation, if it had compromised and strengthened slavery, we might brand it the racist generation or the blundering generation because it failed to come to grips with the crisis that had arisen over slavery. So I am inclined not to agree with the blundering generation interpretation. I think that this was an issue that had to be resolved, or as Lincoln put it, the tug has to come sometime, and better now than any other time. And even though it did eventuate in a terrible war that killed 620,000 people, it also resolved two of the fundamental questions that had plagued Americans right down to 1860. One was slavery, and the other was the question of whether this nation founded in 1776 would hold together or whether it would split apart into fragments.
We know, of course, how the war ended, and as you've mentioned, we know some of the things that the war accomplished. Of course, the men who went off to fight in 1861 and 62 couldn't have known the outcome. What led them, North and South, to fight?
I think both sides were motivated by a powerful sense of nationalism, as they understood it, associated with that question of their veneration of the founders' generation. That is, Northerners said that they were fighting for the preservation of to use a fairly common metaphor that they used, the preservation of the best government on God's footstool. That is, a preservation of a republic in a world where there were few functioning republics, preservation of a nation that they believed was the greatest nation on earth. So against traitors, against treason, they thought that they were fighting to preserve the nation from its destruction by traitors. Southerners thought that they were fighting to preserve a unique way of life from the threat of these black Republican Yankee abolitionists, to use some of the terms that they did, and they used them as epithets, for their southern way of life, for their southern institutions, for their southern culture. All of these phrases together described their sense of a southern nationhood. At first, on both sides, slavery was subordinate to this sense of nationalism, but slavery, of course, was very much tied up and tied in with this sense of a separate and unique southernness. And as the war went on, of course, Northerners increasingly came to see that slavery was at the root of the rebellion, to use, again, a very common phrase that was used at the time, and that there was no way they were going to preserve the Union unless they rooted out the cause of disunion, which was slavery. So even though slavery was subordinated to nationalism on both sides in the first part of the war, it couldn't stay entirely subordinated, and that's why by the time the war had reached 1863, slavery had become an essential part of what both sides were fighting for or against.
Almost certainly the war, tragic as it was, must have been a formative experience for those who went through it. How did it shape them?
For Northern veterans, it increased their sense of a stake in the nation, and especially in a united nation. I think it was a formative experience in the creation of American nationalism. It was that generation that wrote the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. These are all Civil War slogans, and they grew out of the Civil War experience and helped to create that heightened sense of American nationalism in the late 19th and early 20th century that has come on right down to us in the present. In the case of Southern veterans of the war, there was a kind of ambivalence about that experience. On the one hand, of course, they had fought to destroy one nation indivisible and to create a new nation. When they lost, many of them accepted that outcome and pledged their new allegiance, as it were, to the United States. And I think by the late 19th century, after a wave of reconciliation between blue and gray, the encampments and commemorations of the war that brought both sides together, Southerners, even though they had a kind of nostalgic commitment to the memory of the Confederacy and of their heroic underdog effort to win that war, nevertheless kind of clasped hands over the bloody chasm, or across the bloody chasm of the great divide of the Civil War, and rededicated themselves to a new sense of American nationalism. And of course the war institutionally greatly strengthened the central government of the United States. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments vastly increased the powers of the national government. In fact, six of the seven constitutional amendments, starting with the 13th Amendment in 1865, increased the powers of the national government and decreased the powers of the state. And so the war actually accomplished a pretty significant transformation in the balance of powers between the central government and state and local governments.
Historians use all sorts of categories to help understand the past: race, class, gender, ethnicity, for example. I wonder how useful you think generations are. Is there something that looking at generations would do to help us further understand America's past?
Well, my own feelings about the usefulness of generations as an historical category is a bit ambivalent. Partly that's because there are at least two meanings of the word generation. One is all of the people who happen to be alive at a particular time. So when we talk about the Civil War generation, we're talking about those 32 million people who lived in the country in 1861. Another definition of generation is a particular age cohort at a given time. That is the generation from people in their 20s and 30s, something like that. And because of that ambiguity, it's not always clear what people are talking about when they talk about a given generation. And if you're talking about all of the people who happen to be alive at a particular time, especially in the case of the Civil War, you're talking about people who had widely and radically different perspectives on that experience. One-third of them, of course, were associated with the Confederacy. 4 million of them, nearly 14%, were slaves. Many in the North opposed the wars. Many in the South were Unionists. So to talk about a particular generation like the Civil War generation, I'm a little bit reluctant to use that as a powerful category of analysis.
There are so many attempts now by people to talk in terms of generations, and as we all know, particularly to identify a greatest generation. As we close, just a couple of questions. I wonder what you make of the attempts to identify a greatest American generation, and if you have a nominee yourself.
Well, I think the current popularity of that concept grows largely out of Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, and with the commemorations of the past 5 or 6 years associated with the 50th anniversary of World War II. There have been frequent references to the World War II generation or the generation that experienced the Depression and World War II. And that has prompted then others to look back on the generation of the Revolution, the generation of the Civil War. I think that helps to account for the popularity of this concept. I suppose, since I am a Civil War historian, I would have to nominate that generation as the one that came through the greatest crisis that this country has ever experienced and resolved that crisis in a way that laid the groundwork for future expansion of the United States. The existence, the survival of the United States was not at stake in 1940. It was at stake in 1860. So I guess I would have to nominate that generation as the one that came through the greatest crisis in the American experience and did so in the end with flying colors.
We have only less than a minute left. I wonder if there's a kind of historical pattern here. The World War II generation, now half a century after World War II, is receiving this veneration. Was there a similar kind of veneration half a century after the Civil War for those who fought in it?
Yes, I think so. The accounts of the Civil War the memoirs by participants began to achieve an enormous popularity in the 1880s and 1890s. General Grant's funeral in 1885 attracted millions of people and an enormous outpouring of memorialization and praise and so on. The 50th anniversary commemorations of the Civil War from 1911 to 1915 attracted huge numbers of people to various encampments. There were hundreds of thousands who participated in or witnessed the joint blue and gray reunion at Gettysburg in 1913. President Wilson came to it and gave a speech. So yes, there was a kind of veneration 50 years later of the Civil War generation that I think in many ways is comparable to what we have experienced in the last several years with respect to World War II.
Well, Professor McPherson, thank you for visiting with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to do so.
I've been speaking with James McPherson, author of The Battle Cry of Freedom, among other books on the Civil War. His most recent book, an edited collection on the American presidents, is entitled To the Best of My Ability.
Some historians refuse to take part in the conversation about which generation in American history was the greatest, insisting that defining people by generation is the least useful way to look at the past. Historian Stephanie Kuntz believes that race, class, and gender are much more important.
Even as a 19-year-old in the free speech movement back in 1964, I didn't take my fellow activist Jack Weinberg very seriously when he joked that you should never trust anyone over 30. I knew I had more in common with the 50-year-olds who had organized unions in the 1930s and the 40-year-olds who had spearheaded the civil rights movement in the 1940s than with the fraternity boys my own age who were still staging panty raids in those days, or the young thugs, also of my own generation, who were beating up civil rights activists in the South. As someone once remarked, generations are the lowest form of solidarity. Class position, race, ethnicity, religion, gender, even sexuality create far more cross-cutting differences and similarities among people than does the decade of their birth. Many of the characteristics we often attribute to a particular generation are actually what sociologists call period effects rather than cohort effects. For example, in the early 1990s, commentators often blamed the alienation of so-called Gen Xers on their experience with divorce and unwed motherhood in their early years. But the General Social Survey, which has interviewed all age groups every year since the 1970s, found that alienation and disaffection had increased for all Americans, even the very oldest, who certainly had not experienced divorce and unwed motherhood in their formative years. There was something about the 1980s and early 1990s, perhaps the fall in real wages for men and the rise in economic inequality, coupled with a vociferous, well-funded campaign against the public sector, that caused people of all generations to lose social trust. Since 1993, some of that social trust has rebounded, and rates of violence and homicide have fallen dramatically. But I suspect that this, too, is a period effect connected to the economic recovery of 1993 to 2000, even if many of the symptoms have shown up as changes in generational behavior. Obviously, common experiences at critical ages can give rise to common reference points, coping mechanisms, and even emotional proclivities among a generation. But when it comes to the political conclusions people draw and their long-range work and family trajectories, these shared experiences and concerns are still sifted through the grid of race, class, and gender. And they don't remain static over time. Thus, the experiences that led people to trust their government during the New Deal and World War II did not prevent many of them, along with their grandchildren, from believing Ronald Reagan 40 years later, when he said government was the problem, not the solution. Even something as traumatic and initially unifying as the destruction of the World Trade Center is already leading to different perspectives about how to understand and implement seemingly agreed-upon reactions. As unemployment rises, police powers increase, and time limits for welfare mothers begin to expire, people will draw different lessons out of the common vocabulary and shared emotions of the September 11th disaster. I think these will vary more on the basis of class, gender, race, and ethnicity than on the basis of age. Just because a generation shares many common reference points, cultural symbols, catchphrases, and punchlines, doesn't mean it speaks with one voice.
You've been listening to Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history at Evergreen State College and the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. and the way we really are, coming to terms with America's changing families. This is Talking History.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
For our site of the week, we've chosen a city that was shaped by the Civil War and its generation of Americans, as well as by the mighty Mississippi. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Alton, Illinois, located just outside of St. Louis, is a laid-back town where visitors and residents alike spend many hours watching the river, a moving highway of boats, barges, and jet skis. The city was founded in 1818 and would have remained obscure except for one incident that stirred national interest. In 1837, abolitionist newspaper editor Reverend Elijah Lovejoy was killed by an angry mob because of his anti-slavery views. It may have been the event that signaled the first skirmish of the Civil War. Along with a monument to Lovejoy, there is a museum with exhibits devoted to Lovejoy and the passage of slaves to freedom along the Underground Railroad. You will also find the ruins of a Confederate prison, and at the Alton Confederate Cemetery, you will find a monument that honors the more than 1,100 Confederate soldiers who died of smallpox there in the 1860s. Abe Lincoln visited Alton in 1858 in his last debate with Stephen Douglas. Contact the Greater Alton Twin Rivers Convention and Visitors Bureau for more information.
And finally, turning to our segment on coming attractions, we can all use instructions now and then, explanations of how things work, directions on how to proceed. That's what maps and manuals are for, science and codes of ethics. Even certain kinds of art has shown in a new exhibit, Heavenly Visions, Shaker Gift Drawings, and Gift Songs. In the mid-19th century America, the religious sect known as the Shakers, or the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming, was in trouble. Loving memory of the group's magnetic founder, Ann Lee, was fading fast. The end days she predicted were slow in arriving. A faith fueled by charisma and crisis was losing steam, and members were beginning to leave to join other sects or to return to the world. Then in the 1840s, a great revival occurred among the Shakers. Members chosen by Mother Ann became channels for messages or instructions to her people in the form of lovely religious songs and wonderful symbolic visual images. At once didactic and decorative, the drawings have no parallel in American religious history. Most were destroyed when the revival ended, rather than let them fall into the hands of non-believers, but some 200 survived, 80 of which are included in Heavenly Visions, now showing at the Drawing Center, 35 Worcester Street in New York City, through December 15th. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.